Hi, listeners. It's Carter. Before today's episode of Murder True Crime Stories, I want to tell you about another podcast I am hosting. I know you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, I'll take you inside a landmark homicide case. The interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts. This is Crime House. Most people see jury duty as a chore, something they have to do but don't really want to. Others think it's an opportunity to carry out their civic duty and make a difference. However you feel about it, everyone recognizes that it's a huge responsibility, especially if you're part of the jury in a murder trial. And in 2017, that reality was front and center for the people of Cortland, Mississippi. 3 years earlier, 19-year-old Jessica Chambers was burned alive on a country road. Now, 12 men and women were tasked with deciding if her accused killer, 28-year-old Quentin Tallis, was guilty of murder. The verdict had to be unanimous. Unfortunately, the case was anything but straightforward. So while everyone wanted justice, no one could agree on what that meant. People's lives are like a story. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. But you don't always know which part you're on. Sometimes the final chapter arrives far too soon, and we don't always get to know the real ending. I'm Carter Roy, and this is Murder True Crime Stories, a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. New episodes come out every Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, with Friday's episodes covering the cases that deserve a deeper look. Thank you for being part of the Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow the show. And for ad-free access to every episode, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. This is the second of two episodes on the murder of 19-year-old Jessica Chambers in Cortland, Mississippi. Please note, this episode contains graphic descriptions of violence and murder. Please listen with care. Last time, we discussed Jessica's brutal death on December 6, 2014. In the wake of her murder, a task force searched for Jessica's killer, while amateur detectives discussed their own theories online. Investigators were able to drown out the noise, and in February 2016, 27-year-old Quentin Tallis was indicted for Jessica's murder. Today, we'll follow prosecutors into the courtroom as they try to get a conviction. For a moment, it seemed like the Chambers family would finally get the closure they prayed for, but the case against Quentin wasn't so cut and dry. And more than a decade after Jessica's death, we're still not sure what actually happened that day in 2014. All that and more coming up. On December 6, 2014, a 19-year-old former cheerleader named Jessica Chambers was found barely breathing on the side of a rural road in Cortland, Mississippi. Her car, a black Kia Rio, was smoldering beside her. In her final moments, she told firefighters that someone named Eric had attacked her. 6 hours later, Jessica was pronounced dead in the hospital. For the next 10 months, a task force of local and federal officers searched tirelessly for her killer. Armed with the culprit's first name, they thought the hunt would be easy. But by September of 2015, they still had no idea who their mystery man might be. Jessica's friends and family didn't know anyone called Eric. There was nobody in her phone contacts or social media who went by that name either. Detectives carefully eliminated every single Eric and Derek in the local area. None of them had any plausible connection to the murder. As the case made waves online, the investigation was dealt another blow. Armchair detectives from around the world met on Facebook pages to discuss their theories. They actively harassed Cortland residents, sending hate messages and even death threats to anyone they thought was involved in the murder. Detectives tried to tune out the noise and focus on the investigation. So after eliminating every possible Eric in the area, police cast a wider net and considered other possibilities. Then in the fall of 2015, Jessica's former boyfriend, a 27-year-old named Quentin Tellis, was arrested in Louisiana. He'd attempted to activate a debit card that belonged to a dead woman, 34-year-old Mandy Shao. Initially, he was only charged with the unauthorized use of Mandy's card, though police suspected he was also involved in her death. And when authorities in Louisiana looked into Quentin's background, they learned he was connected to the Jessica Chambers murder. Though he'd already been cleared in that case, and they reached out to the Mississippi State Police to inform them of the arrest. That led detectives in Mississippi to take another look at Quentin. Based on location data from his cell phone, it seemed like he had lied to them in the interrogation room months earlier. Quentin originally said he only saw Jessica for about an hour on the morning of her death. Now, the police had evidence that the two of them were together in the evening as well. That was enough to arrest him. On February 23, 2016, Quentin was indicted for the murder of Jessica Chambers while still being held at a jail in Monroe, Louisiana. The announcement came as a shock to Jessica's friends and family. Last they heard, Quentin had a solid alibi. But after speaking to investigators and learning about the new cell phone evidence, they were convinced the police were on the right track. Some of the amateur detectives online disagreed. After the indictment, they congregated on discussion boards to furiously debate the latest charges. Since the murder, many internet users had become convinced that Jessica Chambers was at the center of a vast conspiracy. Without real evidence, they blamed her death on gang violence and drug dealers. These theories were often racially charged because Jessica, a white woman, had dated black men in the past. The harassment got so bad that the authorities publicly dismissed the conspiracies. But no matter what they said, they couldn't stop the trolls. The police hoped a conviction would end the internet debate once and for all. But before his trial date could be set, Quentin was called back to Louisiana. In May of 2016, he pleaded guilty to using Mandy Shao's debit card and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He was still a suspect in Mandy's murder, but Louisiana authorities didn't officially bring any additional charges against him at the time. That might have been because they wanted to see what happened during his court appearance in Mississippi first. In October of 2017, 28-year-old Quentin Tellis stood trial for the murder of Jessica Chambers. From the start, it was clear that the prosecution had an uphill battle ahead of them. The defense began by calling 8 witnesses to the stand. All of them, from firefighters to EMTs to police deputies, were at the scene when Jessica was found on the side of the road, and they all testified that she had blamed the attack on someone named Eric, or possibly Derek. According to them, she repeated the accusation multiple times. The prosecution countered with statements from a forensics expert named Dr. William Hickerson. He claimed that the extreme burns and smoke damage Jessica endured could have prevented her from speaking properly. So while the first responders heard her blame Eric, it was possible she was trying to say something else and just couldn't get the words out. It was up to the jury to decide how much weight to give to Jessica's final words. Next, the prosecution laid out the evidence connecting Quentin to the scene of the crime. They started by claiming that forensic tests found his DNA on Jessica's car keys. But these findings were not 100% conclusive. There was DNA from at least four different males on the keys, and the particular forensic analysis that scientists used, called a Y chromosome STR test, can be unreliable. Technically, experts only determined that Quentin's DNA shared similarities with the DNA on the keys. In other words, it might have been his DNA, but it was impossible to say for sure. For his part, Quentin stated that he had driven Jessica's car before, though not on the day of her death, and forensic experts couldn't determine how fresh the samples on the keys were. While that may have left some room for doubt, the prosecution had saved their strongest evidence for last. They could prove, without a doubt, that Quentin lied to them during the initial investigation. On December 10th, 2014, 4 days after Jessica was killed, the police had interrogated Quentin for the first time. He seemed cooperative. He agreed to take a polygraph, which he passed, and voluntarily gave them a DNA sample. He repeatedly insisted that he had only seen Jessica for about an hour on the morning of her death. He also claimed that he was hanging out with a friend at the time she was killed. 10 months later, the police took a closer look at his story. When they interviewed Quentin's buddy, a man named Mike, he told them he was out of town when Jessica was killed, so he couldn't have seen Quentin that night. Quentin's alibi was completely busted. From then on, the police were convinced he was hiding something. To confirm their suspicions, investigators pored over data from his phone and compared it to Jessica's. The whole process is complicated, but essentially, every mobile phone periodically sends out signals that make contact with the nearest cell tower in the area. These are called pings. They track our phones and ensure our carriers can connect texts, calls, and data to the proper device. These pings don't give the authorities a person's exact whereabouts, only the location of the nearest cell tower. But that's enough to give them a general idea of when and where a person was. That's how the police could prove Quentin was lying during their first round of questioning. On the evening of Jessica's death, both of their phones were pinging the same cell tower. That didn't necessarily mean they were together, but it did mean that Quentin wasn't where he said he was when she died. After being confronted with the evidence in September 2014, Quentin changed his story. He admitted that he met Jessica at Taco Bell in the town of Batesville, a few miles away from Cortland, at around 6 p.m. However, he didn't explain if they went inside or just hung out in the parking lot. Either way, Quentin was adamant that they were only together until 7 p.m. Based on location data, police already knew that Jessica arrived at the scene of her murder on the side of a back road at around 7:30. So, what happened in those 30 minutes? Pings from her phone alerted multiple towers between her home and Batesville, where the Taco Bell was located. But the prosecution needed more details, so they hired an intelligence analyst named Paul Rowlett to take things one step further. On the stand, Rowlett explained how he delved deeper into the cell data. Based on that, he was able to make an educated guess about where Jessica might have been. And his findings put her squarely in range of Quentin Tellis's house. The district attorney called these findings the aha moment. They already knew Quentin lied about seeing Jessica that evening. Now they had evidence that the two of them could have been together right before she died. There was just one final piece of the puzzle left. Jessica Chambers wasn't just murdered. She was burned alive. The prosecution had to explain what made Quentin commit such an unspeakable crime. In October 2017, 28-year-old Quentin Tellis stood trial for the murder of 19-year-old Jessica Chambers. During the first 4 days of proceedings, the prosecution showed that Quentin had lied to them during their initial rounds of questioning. Based on cell phone location data, investigators believed he and Jessica were together before she was burned alive on a rural back road. And though his motive wasn't clear, prosecutors had a theory. They thought that at around 7 p.m., they went back to his house to have sex in her car, and that during the act, there must have been some kind of accident. For whatever reason, maybe because she was choked, Jessica passed out. The prosecution argued that afterwards, Quentin mistakenly believed she was already dead. So, in a panic, he drove her car, with Jessica still in it, to a back road. He dumped her body along with the car, returned to his house to grab a canister of gasoline from his shed, then went back to the scene. To get rid of any evidence, he set both the car and Jessica on fire, then ran away. But there was one thing he didn't account for. Jessica was still alive, and despite the third-degree burns covering more than 90% of her body, she managed to escape the flaming vehicle before an ambulance arrived. Unfortunately for the prosecution, this theory was difficult to prove. There wasn't any evidence found at the scene to corroborate their version of events, and the doctor who performed Jessica's autopsy didn't check to see if she had sex before she died. They could only hope the jury found their arguments persuasive. Since Quentin was potentially facing life in prison without parole, their verdict had to be unanimous. On October 16th, 2017, after a day or two of deliberation, the jury assembled to deliver their verdict. When the judge asked if it was unanimous, the foreman told him it was. But before he could officially announce their decision, another juror spoke up, claiming that he didn't agree with the verdict. The judge, along with everyone else, was stunned. The jury didn't seem to understand what the word unanimous meant. After the judge explained the parameters again, they were dismissed to continue their deliberations. Meanwhile, the lawyers, the families of the victims, and the spectators slowly filtered out of the courtroom in a daze. 30 minutes later, the jury returned. Well, this time, no one interrupted when the foreman said the decision was unanimous. They found Quentin Tellis not guilty of first-degree murder. Sighs of relief came from his side of the aisle, while Jessica's family and friends burst into tears. But the drama wasn't over yet. Given the previous confusion, the prosecution requested that each individual juror state on the record that they agreed with the verdict. The first two people said they did. The next juror didn't. Neither did the one after that. In the end, it seemed like opinions were nearly split in half. There wasn't a unanimous verdict after all, not even close. The baffled judge questioned the jury until he finally identified the problem. They were in a complete deadlock, with holdouts on both sides refusing to change their opinions. But for some reason, they believed that since they couldn't reach a unanimous decision, Quentin would be found not guilty by default. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. An official verdict of not guilty has to be unanimous, just like a guilty verdict would be. For the second time, the jury was ordered to return to their deliberations. People outside their room could hear the jurors screaming at each other inside. The uproar continued for the next hour until finally the foreman sent a message to the judge. They were never going to reach a unanimous decision. This is called a hung jury, and it resulted in a mistrial for Quentin Tellis, meaning he wasn't found guilty, but he wasn't out of the woods either. The prosecution could bring charges against him a second time and try arguing their case in front of a different jury. Days after the mistrial, prosecutors announced that they planned to make some tweaks to their case and do exactly that. In the meantime, Quentin was sent back to Louisiana to continue serving his sentence for the unauthorized use of Mandy Shao's debit card. Eventually, Quentin's second trial was scheduled for September 24th, 2018. But before he could take the stand, his defense team launched some explosive allegations against the local district attorney, John Champion. Sometime around June, about 3 months before the retrial, Quentin's attorney, Darla Palmer, got a call from a man named Jalen Cottle. Jalen was Quentin's cellmate when he was imprisoned in Mississippi. And according to Jalen, John Champion offered him leniency for his own case in exchange for testifying against Quentin in the upcoming trial. Allegedly, Champion went so far as to tell Jalen to lie. He reportedly wanted Jalen to tell the court that Quentin used to go by the name Eric when he first met Jessica Chambers. If Jalen was telling the truth, it meant the district attorney was attempting to fabricate evidence. Darla Palmer took John Champion to court over the story, asking that a judge officially remove him from the Jessica Chambers case. By that point, Champion had been a practicing attorney for over 25 years. His entire reputation as a lawyer was at stake. On the stand, he denied the allegations and claimed the entire ordeal was a misunderstanding. He said another attorney tipped him off that Jalen wanted to testify against Quentin. Jalen was the one who told him about Jessica's alleged pet name. Champion said he dismissed the tip as implausible after he spoke to Jalen in prison. The meeting in question wasn't taped, so it was his word against Jalen's. In the end, the judge didn't believe there was any misconduct that would affect the outcome of Quentin's retrial. So the district attorney was kept as the lead prosecutor on the Jessica Chambers case. All the drama only added fuel to the fire going into the second trial. By the middle of 2018, it had been 3.5 years since Jessica's death. And despite the questions that had been raised, her family fully believed Quentin Tellis was guilty. On the other side, Quentin's family and friends were just as confident that he was innocent. Then, as always, there was a committed group of internet sleuths who were somewhere in the middle. Many saw Quentin's mistrial as vindication of their conspiracies. They continued to believe Jessica Chambers was deeply enmeshed in a web of gangs and drug dealers prior to her murder. The prevailing theory among this crowd is that multiple people were involved in the murder, which was carried out to ensure Jessica couldn't snitch to the police. Some were so wrapped up in this narrative that they looked for connections everywhere. And in the months leading up to the retrial, the online mob descended on Quentin's sister, LaQuinta. She became the target of social media scrutiny after one user spotted a tattoo on her hand that read, "Eric." People speculated that she had some connection to Jessica's killer. Within hours, the theory spread all over the internet. LaQuinta was forced to make a public statement clarifying that the tattoo referenced her ex-boyfriend. He didn't live in Cortland, and she hadn't seen him in over 6 years. He had no connection to Jessica. Sadly, it was yet another example of the internet mob leaping to conclusions and invading the privacy of innocent bystanders. Luckily, the controversy blew over in time for the retrial, but it proved that even in 2018, the case still captivated people online. Going into the proceedings in September, the people of Cortland were hoping that the worst would be behind them soon. Both Jessica's family and Quentin's were looking for closure. But the case just never seemed to end. And there was one last twist in store. On September 24th, 2018, 29-year-old Quentin Tellis stood trial for the murder of 19-year-old Jessica Chambers for the second time. A year earlier, the proceedings had ended in a mistrial. To avoid that fate a second time, the judge in Batesville, Mississippi, had the new jurors selected from a nearby county 120 miles away. The judge hoped they would have less of a personal connection to the murder and would therefore be more objective when considering the facts. But given all the media attention, it was hard to believe that anyone in Mississippi hadn't heard about the case. Still, only time would tell how the new jury reacted. When the proceedings began, those who attended the first trial felt a sense of déjà vu. The same judge presided over the case from the same courtroom, and the prosecution laid out a similar argument to the one they used in 2017. But there were some key differences. Back in 2017, some of the jurors who voted not guilty told the media that Jessica's final words convinced them Quentin couldn't be the killer. The specter of the mysterious Eric just loomed too large for them to ignore. So this time, the prosecution brought in a new expert, a speech pathologist named Dr. Carolyn Higdon. She testified that because of Jessica's injuries, it simply wouldn't have been possible for her to make any articulate sounds when the paramedics found her. To bolster their argument, the prosecution even took the jury on a nighttime field trip to the scene of the crime, using the actual emergency vehicles that responded to the 911 call. They simulated the scene, complete with sirens and ringing phones. They were trying to show that all the background noise and chaos would have made it even more difficult for the firefighters and paramedics to hear Jessica back in 2014. But holding court by flashlight out in the middle of nowhere frustrated the judge. He cut the field trip short in the middle of the defense's cross-examination. The jury was ordered back to the courtroom to resume the trial. The decision left the prosecution in a sort of limbo. Hoping to regain the momentum, they called another new witness to the stand, a woman named Sherry Flowers. Sherry lived near the site where Jessica was found and told the court that after the fire, she picked up a hitchhiker outside her house. She didn't come forward earlier because she didn't think it had anything to do with Jessica's case. Observers expected the prosecution to explicitly accuse Quentin of being the hitchhiker. But Sherry said she couldn't really recall what the stranger looked like. All she could remember was that he was a black man who she had never seen before. By the time she left the stand, some jurors were scratching their heads. The hitchhiker might have been Quentin, but he also could have been a completely different person. It was hard to see how calling Sherry to testify helped the state's case. After that, the second trial played out just like the first, and the jury heard about Jessica's keys, which may or may not have had Quentin's DNA on them, and about the holes in his alibi at the time of the murder. When the closing arguments ended, the jury deliberated for more than 12 hours over the course of 2 days. Then, on October 1st, 2018, the foreman sent a familiar message to the judge. For the second time, the jury was deadlocked. They couldn't reach a unanimous verdict. That meant it was another mistrial, and once again, the decision devastated Jessica's family. They had been waiting for closure for years. Her mother, Lisa, had taken the stand twice now, forced to relive her daughter's final agonizing hours and her tragic death. She endured it all because she believed it would lead to justice, but now the case was back at square one. After two mistrials, the district attorney decided not to prosecute Quentin Tellis a third time. Without significant changes to their case, they just risked putting the community through more pain for an unsatisfying result. Those on Quentin's side believed Jessica's killer was still out there, and that the police could hunt down the mysterious Eric. But the authorities weren't interested in reopening the case. Despite the mistrial, they were confident that Quentin Tellis was guilty. To them, there was no point in revisiting the investigation unless there was some new game-changing evidence or a surprise witness. Until then, Jessica's case was left officially unsolved. Quentin Tellis was sent back to prison in Louisiana, where he still had 8 years left of his sentence for stealing a debit card that belonged to Mandy Shaw. But his legal troubles were far from over. As a reminder, back in 2015, Mandy was stabbed more than 30 times in her apartment. Shortly afterward, Quentin attempted to use her card to withdraw $1,000 from an ATM. For years, the state police said that he was a prime suspect in her death. But after he pleaded guilty to using her card in 2016, they had declined to bring murder charges against him. That all changed in 2019, a few months after the Jessica Chambers case concluded. In May, the state of Louisiana charged the 30-year-old with Mandy's murder, but several delays prevented them from setting an official trial date. The COVID pandemic might have been one obstacle. The uncertain status of the Jessica Chambers case could have been another. Whatever the reasoning, by 2022, 3 years after his indictment, Quentin still hadn't gone to trial for Mandy's murder, so that year a judge dismissed the indictment entirely. He said the state had taken too long to build their case. Quentin's constitutional right to a speedy trial was violated. Even so, he wasn't entirely out of the woods. The state appealed the decision, and in 2024, a judge overturned it. He ordered the prosecution to set a date for Quentin to stand trial for Mandy's murder. By that time, Quentin was 36, and a year later, in March of 2025, there was still no trial scheduled. The reason for the repeated holdups was unclear. But in June, the district attorney held a hearing to get a status update on the case. After that, prosecutors finally set the date for December 1st, 2025. That day came and went. The trial was delayed yet again because one of the state's expert witnesses suddenly died just days before he was supposed to appear in court. The judge gave the prosecution a month to replace their expert, but on January 5th, The state asked for another delay because one of the prosecutors was sick with the flu and needed time to recover. Believe it or not, the trial was delayed again because of a winter storm. A few days later, it was the same story. Currently, 38-year-old Quentin Tellis is scheduled to stand trial for the murder of Mandy Shao in March of 2026. Whether or not those proceedings actually take place is anyone's guess. It's a tough pill to swallow. Mandy's family has been waiting over a decade for justice. Jessica's loved ones have been in limbo for even longer. Sadly, they may never get the answers they're looking for, but that doesn't mean they're giving up. When Jessica Chambers was murdered, the people of Cortland lost an important member of their community. They rallied around Jessica's family and demanded justice. Armchair detectives took advantage of that anger and tried to turn neighbors against one another. Jessica's loved ones say that's not what she would have wanted. In life, she brought people together. And in death, she can too. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Carter Roy, and this is Murder, True Crime Stories. Come back next time for the story of a new murder and all the people it affected. Murder, True Crime Stories is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. Here at Crime House, we want to thank each and every one of you for your support. If you like what you heard today, reach out on social media at Crime House on TikTok and Instagram. Don't forget to rate, review, and follow Murder, True Crime Stories wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback truly makes a difference. And to enhance your Murder, True Crime Stories listening experience, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. You'll get every episode ad-free. We'll be back on Friday. Murder, True Crime Stories is hosted by me, Carter Roy, and is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. This episode was brought to life by the Murder, True Crime Stories team, Max Cutler, Ron Shapiro, Alex Benedon, Natalie Pertofsky, Lori Marinelli, Sarah Camp, Tara Wells, Hania Saeed, Nicolette Tavallero, Cassidy Dillon, and Russell Nash. Thank you for listening. Hi, listeners. It's Carter. Before today's episode of Murder True Crime Stories, I want to tell you about another podcast I am hosting I know you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, I'll take you inside a landmark homicide case. The interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.